hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And up today, pretty much the entire hour devoted to a conversation with three political economists, Leo Panitch, Sam Gindin, and Greg Albo, who are the authors of a new short but essential book, In and Out of Crisis, The Global Financial Meltdown and Left Alternatives, which is just out from PM Press, a relatively new press on the scene, worth checking out. And this book, very much worth checking out. Okay, before we get to all that, just some words of the economic news. In the U.S., more signs of a modest recovery. Early in the week, we learned that retail sales rose an okay 0.3% in February. Weak auto sales dragged down that headline figure. Stripping them out, sales rose by a pretty healthy 0.8% last month. Sales of electronics and appliances, sporting goods, and at restaurants and bars were unusually strong. The mix was a departure from recent retail behavior when spending on necessities predominated. Now we're seeing more indulgence and frivolity in the mix. And in another departure from recent behavior, it looks like the upper end is opening up its wallets. Throughout the recession, purveyors of so-called luxury goods, let's say so-called because many of them are actually aspirational goods purchased by people who want to appear richer than they are. But anyway, those lagged behind the averages, with discounters and wholesale clubs picking up market share, gaining more than the average, and generally behaving more strongly than the rest of the retail sector. But now, luxury sales are picking up again. But, in a reminder of just what a bifurcated world we're living in, the discounters and wholesalers are still doing pretty well, but the middle is really lagging. I doubt that these retail figures announce the beginning of a return to exuberance, or even an extended round of recreational shopping. They do suggest the effects of what some analysts have called recession fatigue. That is, people are tired of bad times and are letting their belts out a notch. If they have belts, that is. The job market, while it's a lot better than it was a year ago, is still weak, and unemployment, especially the chronic long-term sort, is very high. But it's looking like people with jobs are spending a little more freely. Jumping off data like this, and the not-bad February employment report, some excitable Wall Street types are talking about a recovery accelerating into something actually strong. This strikes me as hard to believe. Among the bull's favorite pieces of evidence is the loss of just 36,000 jobs in February. Since there was a bad snowstorm in the Northeast during the week, the employment surveys were taken, which supposedly would depress employment significantly. The enthusiasts are saying that underlying employment trends are now turning strongly upwards. I doubt that the storm effect is anywhere near as strong enough to knock 100 or 200,000 workers off the rolls, so I'm skeptical that there's a strong upturn that was buried under a foot of February snow. It's likely we're going to start seeing some mildly positive job numbers in the coming months, but not the 300,000 you'd expect in a textbook recovery. Confirmation of this expectation came with Thursday's release of the cyclical indicators from the Conference Board. Their coincident index, which is an average of four major economic indicators designed to give a summary picture of the state of that abstraction known as the economy, rose a modest 0.1% in February. That's about half the average for an economic recovery and a third the average seen in a strong recovery. It's pretty much in line with what we saw in the weak recoveries of the early 1990s and early 2000s. The Conference Board's leading index, which is designed to forecast movements in the broad economy 3 to 6 months in the future, also rose just 0.1%. That's about a quarter of the rate we'd be seeing in an average recovery and a sixth of what we'd see in a strong one. So putting all this together, I see no reason to change my prognosis. We're now about 8 months into an economic recovery that's going to be a grinding, frustrating thing that will feel to many of us like the recession still hasn't ended. It's good news that things aren't getting worse, but they're not doing all that much better either. Earlier in the week, the Federal Reserve announced, after its regular policy setting meeting, that it will continue to keep interest rates exceptionally low, as they've been saying, for an extended period of time. The language of their press release suggested slightly more optimism, but not as much as Wall Street's bulls are now exuding. The release pointed to, for example, employers' continuing reluctance to hire. In fact, the use of that phrase in conjunction with their description of the labor market as stabilizing sounded so much like what I've been saying here that I almost got worried. But still, the Federal Reserve's continued indulgence is good news. What recovery we've seen is largely a result of the Fed's easy money and the federal government's stimulus program. But that stim pack will start to fade late this year, and it's not clear whether the economy will have acquired enough of its own internal juice to survive the withdrawal of all that stimulative money from Washington. Fiscal policy is going to turn rather dramatically contractionary in 2011 and 2012, a rather scary prospect that almost no one in Washington or the punditocracy seems worried about. You're hearing a lot of talk about austerity and budget cutting, much more so than about the risks of tightening fiscal policy in a still weak economy. But our austerity party has nothing on the Germans, who are the current world champs of sadomonetarism. A few weeks ago, the Greek economist Yanis Varoufakis said on this show that a source at the European Central Bank, a German national, by the way, told him that the Germans were quite eager to put his country and the other weaklings in the periphery of Europe through the ringer, because they don't want to fund a bailout, and because they figure that they export all their goodies like BMWs to the elites of those poorer countries, so the masses be damned. The other day, the French finance minister, a far more respectable voice than the radical economist interviewed on Behind the News, urged the Germans to loosen up, but so far the Germans will have none of it. They also don't want to set up some sort of intra-European version of the IMF to run bailouts. They correctly perceive that such a body wouldn't be as stringent in its demands for austerity as the existing IMF would be. Under EU pressure, Greece has already agreed to budget cuts and tax hikes that are almost 5% of GDP, a very stiff dose of austerity, but twice as much as what the United States is on board for in the next couple of years. That have me rather worried about the risks of fiscal policy fomenting another recession. The EU probably expects more than what Greece has already done, but that's about all it can get in just the first year. The result of this fiscal tightening will almost certainly be a deep recession. But does austerity actually work? Work in the sense of restoring economic growth after a period of pain imposed by non-elites by elites, that is. It doesn't seem so. In a note to clients earlier this week, Citigroup wrote this. It is interesting at this point to draw some comparisons between the Greek and Irish consolidating plans. Consolidating is a nice euphemism for austerity. Ireland has been praised as a benchmark to follow in terms of its swift and bold turn in fiscal policy that is very close to the total fiscal effort envisaged by Greece now. However, despite the belt tightening over the past year, the Irish budget balance has not yet shown signs of improvement, and it still looks remarkably similar to the Greek one. The Irish budgetary position has not managed to improve yet after almost a year since the introduction of the fiscal austerity package, mainly because of the collapse in real and nominal growth, which was, in part, induced by the fiscal tightening itself. That's the end of the quote from Citigroup. Surprise, surprise, bloodletting can be hazardous to your health. Okay, let's take a break and we'll bring on the Canadians.
Take you back where it all began. Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, and they shut down the mines with the fleet truncheon and took away all banking regulation.
I opened my paper this morning. What did I see? The global market in chaos, problems with securities, international financial crisis,
some kind of subprime.
And that a bit of International Financial Crisis, the radio edit by the members, a reprise of their song from, oh gosh, it's almost 30 years ago, Offshore Banking Business. And they changed the lyrics some, but it's a pretty similar tune. That available on an MP3 download from the usual sources. I don't believe it actually has a physical release. Okay, we're now joined in the studio by three political economists who hang around York University's fabulous political science department and who are the collective authors of a new book, In and Out of Crisis, The Global Financial Meltdown and Left Alternatives. In the studio, Greg Albo, Sam Gindin and Leo Panitch. Sam and Leo, of course, have been on this show quite a few times before, but I believe this is Greg's debut. Welcome to all three of you.
Hello.
Hi, Doug.
So this book, I should say, just out from PM Press, a relatively new label, which looks like it's got some exciting prospects, and this is a very fine book. If I might quote my own blurb, which is on this book, once again, Panitch, Gindin, and Albo show that they have few rivals and no betters in analyzing the relations between politics and economics, between globalization and American power, between theory and the quotidian reality, between crisis and political possibility. At once sobering and inspiring, this is one of the few pieces of writing that I've seen that's essential to understanding, to paraphrase a term from accounting, the sources and uses of crisis, splendid and essential. And unlike many examples of this genre, I actually mean what I said when I wrote that blurb. So congratulations to the three of you for writing such a fine little book that, that everyone in the audience
should pick up.
Well, you're welcome. Also, my wife blurbed it, and Sam noted the other day I should have got my four-year-old son as well to give this a family project. Where do we start with something like this? I guess, what's your analysis of where this crisis came from? There are many, you know, mainstream explanations, greed, deregulation, irresponsibility. You know, there are even a lot of the same explanations that come further on the left, not all that dissimilar. Then, of course, there's the falling rate of profit structural crisis theory that some people on the left are fond of. What is your particular explanation of just how the financial system froze up in 2007 and drove the world into recession in 2008? Looks like Sam has been nominated to start the answer.
Let me say something quite general before we get into specifics, and that's how we approach the question of understanding where finance fits into the picture. And I think we have to understand finance as not being dysfunctional to capitalism, but being absolutely crucial to the development of capitalism, that finance was absolutely critical to, obviously, credit, but not just credit, to managing risk. It was fundamental to capitalism actually being able to go global. So the crucial contradiction is that on the one hand, capitalism desperately needs finance to be innovative, dynamic, expansive, to stretch the boundaries so that capitalism can go further. But then there are these contradictions within finance in terms of, as you put it, in managing risk. It also creates new systemic risk.
Yeah, well, you're talking about finance at a very high level of abstraction. So, you know, credit certainly is necessary to expand beyond the boundaries of the immediate. But collateralized debt obligations, what's the contribution of those things?
Well, I mean, all kinds of new instruments have been invented over the last 40 years, and some of them probably are more functional and some of them more dysfunctional than others. And it may well be the case that in the last decade before the crisis, some of those that were pushed and became very popular were problematic in terms of a degree of speculation that the system couldn't sustain. But I think the point that Sam was trying to make is that capitalism needs speculation in order to do the things that we all take as essential to any system of production and exchange. Yeah, in a global economy, you need to have speculators in order to be able to hedge the risk on trading different currencies as you contract to ship goods from one side of the world to another 6 months from now, or to buy oil 6 months from now. Speculation is built into the capitalist system. It's built into it even amongst industrialists who are taking a risk when they engage in a long-term investment.
Now, this gets to a point, I think, a lot of people, a lot of critics, populists in particular, of left and right, would argue or think that there's somehow, as they say in law, a fine, bright line between production and finance, between whatever and speculation, whatever non-speculation is. You guys think that no such line exists, right?
Well, I'd say there's a distinction to be made, but they also depend on one another. So it's not the case that here on Wall Street, the guys who are walking around are actually making a lot of useful things in the sense of use values. But they are doing things that those who produce use values, especially in a world of globalized capitalism, absolutely need. Now, I say especially in a world of globalized capitalism, even the small farmer absolutely needed it in a capitalist economy that is based on exchange value. And we're seeing the contradictions of that in our time, but they're contradictions in which industrial capitalists are embedded. They're contradictions in which working class people who are dependent on banks for credit, for their mortgages, for the place where they get their paychecks each week are dependent.
Yeah, Sam, you said when I interviewed you here a couple of months ago that one of the characteristic features of neoliberalism was that it really brought workers into the circuits of capital in ways that they hadn't been before. Could you just talk a bit about what you meant by that?
Yeah, that neoliberalism wasn't just an attack on working people, but it integrated them. And it integrated them in a number of ways. One was simply in terms of extending the hours of work, which was crucial. Because it also means you have less time to participate and be political. But in terms of the circuits of capital, it means that workers are now not just people who are in debt. They're savers, they're lenders. Through their pension funds, they're very concerned about what's happening to the stock market. They see their homes not just a place that they live in, but an asset for the future. So they're plugged into rising the bubbles, financial bubbles.
And that view of a house is speculative. It's not producing current income. By the strict definition of speculation,
yeah.
It's a rising price that's supposed to provide the payoff. That is the definition of speculation.
Yeah, so you're locked in from, you know, all the very small daily things like, you know, when there's a crisis, are you going to be able to cash your check? But also, even without a crisis, depending on financial speculation, essentially, and the boom in assets, to increase your income and set aside income for retirement. And that's especially true when your income has been, basically been frozen for so long.
Some critics of yours on the left would argue that you guys have been too sanguine about crisis not happening. And here we are, we got this bone-crunching crisis people, you know, are saying the worst since 70 years. What happened? Were you taken by surprise? Did it cause you to rethink anything?
I was going to let Greg get in, but he's probably least responsible for this than Sam and I are, so probably one of us better come back on that question. Our argument has been that financial capitalism in the age of what we call global finance has been extremely dynamic, but it's also been extremely volatile, and part of its dynamism has been based on competitiveness in that system and increasingly ratcheting up the leverage in that system. And the extensiveness of it has made it very, very crisis prone. Our argument has been that the state, especially the Fed and the Treasury, the U.S. Fed and Treasury, have played an enormously important role in acting as firefighters, and to some extent as introducing certain types of regulation in certain arenas that led these crises not to be as severe as everyone constantly predicted they would be. We never argued that there wouldn't be future crises. Our argument was that these would not necessarily lead to the collapse of the system, precisely because the state under neoliberalism, far from pulling out of the system, became more and more active in it. And I think in that sense we've been confirmed. You know, when the crisis broke out, we argued that it was a deep and very serious one, and much more serious than the earlier ones, that they'd managed to put the fire out more quickly. But we thought that unless there was working class resistance of a massive kind, unless there was the type of state action that would attempt to transform the economy, that the system would recover. And I think it is recovering, not in the sense that it's able to provide employment to everybody, but in the sense that it is not subject to its terminal decline, as other people on the left have often greeted these crises. I think we've been right.
I think the important difference is thinking of crises as very long terminal drawn-out processes, which I think has been plaguing the left's understanding of neoliberalism over the last 25, 30 years, of just thinking this entire phase as a long period of crisis.
Yeah, it's the old graybeard said, permanent crises do not exist. Right?
And it is actually a contradiction or against Marx's own thoughts, where he talked about crises being sharp shocks that turned into really rapidly restructured capital. And I think that's the key distinction where we've been all in common. And I think the other point has been, of course, that all of us have tried to think through the characteristic crises internal to neoliberalism. And that has been particularly the systematic forms of financial crisis that have characterized neoliberalism going back to the 1980s. And these have always been fairly large cyclical crisis internal to neoliberalism and involving a lot of restructuring that moved over from the financial sector into the productive economy as well. But these have been characteristic internal to neoliberalism rather than kind of a long, drawn-out period.
But now the systems masters have been able in those crises to turn them to their advantage. Like the classic example, the early 1980s debt crisis, Latin America, was a lever through which the entire hemisphere's political and economic arrangements are transformed. Do you think they're going to be able to turn this one to their advantage, or is this a little bit more of a challenge?
Well, we'll have to see. To some extent, as you say in the current Left Business Observer, they have already turned it to their advantage in terms of the way Wall Street, at least, is now paying itself these fancy bonuses again while people are living on food stamps and unemployment checks. We'll have to see the extent to which they can do so. One of the ways they may turn it to their advantage is through changing the regulatory system to some extent, that it is so that it actually is more capable of preventing crises being this deep. One of the very interesting things that is coming out in the current testimony before Congress today, when both Bernanke and Volcker were there together, saying you got to leave Fed in control of the system, was the way in which they pointed out that at the time of the 1987 stock market crash, the Fed had played a crucial role in preventing that from turning into a much greater crisis than it was. At that time, that involved pumping a lot of liquidity into the system. It was the Greenspan put. But they were, to some extent, by virtue of their regulatory capacities, able to act very quickly in that respect. This time, although they tried to do it, it didn't have that immediate effect. But they may, as a result of this crisis, learn a few things.
That's the voice of Leo Panitch, who is here in the studio along with his co-authors of the book In and Out of Crisis, Greg Albo and Sam Gindin. And Sam Gindin wanted to make a point.
Well, no, in terms of the question of how are they coming out of this, already the main thing that's happened is that instead of them being discredited, delegitimated, right now it's the working class that's on the defensive again, and that's very telling. And the other thing is that if you look at specific things like the auto industry, the real story in the auto industry isn't that GM almost went bankrupt, because through that process it actually restructured, got rid of its debt, got rid of a lot of its healthcare responsibilities, got concessions. The real story is what happened to the union in that context, the extent to which the union, which was faltering already, really came out of that crisis demolished and set a precedent for other industrial unions.
Yeah, it's functionally ceased to exist, doesn't it? You can't hear him shaking his head.
I'm saying yes in terms of the union as a whole. What you're beginning to see is some resistance from below, and there's some hope in that.
But I was amazed to see, I think today's Thursday's Wall Street Journal, that the SEC was siding with the Wall Street investment banks to bring down the barriers between investment banking and the analysts who write up their corporate reports. This was supposed to be one of the post-dot-com bust reforms. It was supposed to be some degree of independence in the analysts who are not supposed to be just adjuncts to the sales effort for the investment bankers and brokers. The SEC, supposedly the regulator, is siding with Wall Street. Now, what struck me about this was that it's not even the interest of the broadest sector of the capitalist class. This is a very, very narrow interest for a few big Wall Street banks. I'm just really struck by how a very narrow class fraction has such a position of power in the United States now that they can really dictate policy.
This is Leo speaking. But I don't think it's just now. I think that's always been true. And there's always been an element of the American state in particular, which has so little relative autonomy from capitalists that it's incapable of standing autonomous from the interests of very particular groups of capitalists.
But this is even against the investing class and the CEO class.
Yeah, and I think that is a problem. And it's one of the dysfunctionalities in the role that the American state plays as the imperial guarantor for world capitalism. And that's one of the reasons that these crises sometimes are deeper than they should be. I wanted to make one other point that probably Greg can make better than I in terms of what's going to come out of this that may be advantageous to the capitalist class as a whole and will allow them, give them the space to do these kinds of shenanigans. And that is that it's public sector unions who may finally be destroyed as a result of this particular crisis. You know,
we have a Democratic president going after the teachers' union.
Exactly.
Quite shocking.
Exactly. Insofar as union density anywhere in Western capitalist countries, but especially in North America, has remained significant, it's been in the public sector, where those benefits that were lost in the private sector around pensions, around health care, et cetera, were retained was in the public sector, reflecting the fact that the state has to some extent be a universal representative. What is now happening is that the public sector, because of the size of the deficits everywhere, is being targeted, public employees are being blamed, and there's this reverse class prejudice whereby auto workers say, if I don't no longer have health care and a pension, why the hell should a teacher have it? As if they're going to be any better off if their kid's teacher doesn't have these things. Nevertheless, that is being played on in an extremely dangerous way with enormous pressure on public sector unions and workers as a result.
Greg, did you have something?
Yeah, I think that's the critical area where how this crisis might unfold in unexpected ways right now, particularly in Europe, where the attempt to deal with the bringing back the debt so much into the public sector is leading to a huge round of austerity, with the International Monetary Fund, the European Union, the American government, many other places calling for a decade of austerity, and I think the confrontations in and around that will focus on public sector workers. 70% of the expenditures of government are on public employees, and the only way that they can deal with the fiscal crisis is to go after public sector workers, unless they're going to do more on the revenue side. But it's quite incredible how much they've maintained neoliberalism's focus on nothing to do with taxes and maintaining the tax cuts and the distributional level of government sources of revenue the way that has evolved over the last 30 years. So I think that's the focus. I think the struggles in Greece right now, Portugal, Ireland, where there's been general strikes, another one coming up in France and around these things, that'll be the critical question. In North America, we don't have the political foundation to respond to that at all in exactly the same way, but there might be some spillover, particularly in the confrontations in the Canadian public sector, which the unions have been meeting with over regularly over the last few months, as the budgets start moving towards austerity in Canada. That might have a major impact, which might fuel or fuse with some of the events that have been occurring in California as well over the public sector austerity structures attacks there as well.
All right, since we're at the half-hour mark, we should take a little break, and we'll be back to talk more about this. And this is WBAI in New York, not only at 99.5 on your FM dial, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And if you visit that website, don't neglect to hit that donate button. We could always use whatever help you can send our way. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about crisis.
Our sun will shine
at some of, and tomorrow the stock exchange will be The Human Race by the band McCarthy from back in 1989. All right, we're back here with Sam Gindin, Leo Panitch, and Greg Albo, in the order they're sitting from my point of view. And they are the collective authors of the book In and Out of Crisis, The Global Financial Meltdown and Left Alternatives, just out from PM Press. Sam, you wanted to talk a little bit more about the fractions of the class?
Well, just I thought it was a great question, and just wondering about it. Why is it that the state is still going to be, is still catering to certain sections of the capitalist class through this deep crisis and not acting on behalf of the class as a whole? And it's not just the example of the SEC that you raised. You might also say that about healthcare, that in the long term, simply catering to the health industry actually hurts the American business class as a whole, with the U.S. ending up spending almost twice as much as anybody else on healthcare and affecting competitiveness of companies. And part of that is the irony of how this works its way through. Maybe part of this is because they've actually been able to survive this crisis enough that they're back to just responding to the sections of Wall Street that they're closest to. Maybe if there was, in fact, a response from workers, which I think would have been absolutely necessary, it would have actually pushed a more comprehensive response on health care. So the dynamics of what happens in terms of the relationship...
Well, the labor movement has been missing in action or worse on health care. The major involvement now has been trying to prevent the so-called Cadillac tax, which alienates them from the rest of the working class. So it's just, it looks like they're defending a private little nest of privilege, and everyone else can go to hell.
Absolutely. The reality of being in that kind of survival mode and just defending themselves is that in the end they can't defend themselves, because the only way you can defend yourself is with a much more political, class-oriented response. And we can respond to that later as we talk more about alternatives.
Well, since our time is somewhat limited, I did want to turn to another question. A lot of people have said that this crisis represents the end of two things, which are very closely related things, the neoliberalism itself and American dominance that we're seeing, the erosion of U.S. power. And I do want to read something I read in the Wall Street Journal the other day about the Chinese Premier Wen's annual press conference. It's pretty amazing that the leader of China has only one press conference a year. But in it, he said, his forthright comments, which he's very critical of the United States, reflected a new dynamic in what is arguably the most important bilateral relation in the world. As the only major economy still growing strongly and the U.S.'s largest creditor, China is behaving with new assertiveness. Beijing has emerged from the global recession with fresh confidence about its state-led economy, which has delivered stimulus projects from high-speed railways to highways and bridges with remarkable efficiency. At the same time, it makes no secret of its disdain for U.S. economic management and is in no mood to be lectured by Washington about how to support the world economy. It's pretty funny. Yesterday, I think Chuck Schumer said he's tired of being lectured by China, but it looks like the Chinese are coming up in the world. So does this represent some kind of seismic shift in global relations, or is U.S. power still at the top of the heap?
I don't think it represents a moment of a break between China and the United States or any other part of the world of global capitalism in the United States. I think in the same week that that interview took place, the head of the agency that is responsible for investing the Chinese surplus said very clearly that they had no alternative but to keep on investing it in U.S. Treasury bonds and on Wall Street. And that's because they are in a symbiotic relationship with the United States. They remain utterly structured into growth via their export market. That export market primarily depends on the American and, to a lesser extent, Western European consumers. People here don't know the extent to which China's rapid development has been associated with foreign direct investment from the Western advanced capitalist countries, and that's hardwired into that system of development. That's not to say that China's development as a capitalist power under the aegis of the communist elite has not been remarkable. It's an historic development, absolutely historic. But it's one that is structured into global capitalism. And if the Chinese were to take on the Americans, they would have to break with that. It appears to me that they are in the same structural relationship that Japan has been in since really the 1960s, 1950s, 1960s, and they're unable to escape it.
Well, the U.S. wants them to revalue their currency, and the U.S. really has no leverage over them to get to the debt.
Well, the U.S. has always wanted the Japanese to revalue their currency. Sometimes they forced them to do it, with consequences that weren't always so great when they did it back in the mid-'80s and then gave them some slack again. It was one of the things that led to the stock market crash. It was one of the things that led to the recession of the early 90s. There will be that kind of jockeying, obviously. And it'll have marginal effects as they put more or less pressure on them. The Chinese do some revaluing or they don't. But this isn't fundamental. This is playing at the margins.
Sam?
Yeah, just to elaborate a little bit on what Leo said, and then Greg may want to jump in. The point about the structural relationship is crucial to what we've all been both trying to understand and theorize about the nature of the American state, that the American state plays a particular role in setting the framework for all of capital. And everybody depends on that, including China and Japan, in terms of the U.S. being able to strengthen and deepen global capital and manage it in a particular way that they can accumulate within their own countries and benefit from it. And in some ways, you know, everybody talks about China being a banker for the U.S. You could turn that around and think in terms of the U.S. is the banker. China's depositing its surpluses into the U.S., and the U.S. is spending it on its own consumers, on investment, on FDI abroad, on the military. So it's a structural relationship. This isn't about the U.S. being omnipotent in a way that it gets everything the way it wants. It's about the U.S. being at the center of a global empire that everybody is linked into and depends on.
It's been interesting to watch the Greek crisis and what the EU's reaction has been. Because one of the things that struck me is that Germany, to be a proper hegemon, needs to spend a little more freely, and it refuses to. It's very tight-fisted, and it seems very provincial and cramped in its thinking. So it doesn't look likely that the EU is going to be any kind of possible competitor to the United States as an imperial center.
Yeah, well, the European Union and the German economy are a bit parallel to the Chinese case with their structural current account surpluses going back to the 1960s. And these are then in relationship to the rest of the world market, but then in particular inside the European Union, which has a very large asymmetry between the German surpluses and the deficits in the remaining countries, particularly in the so-called PIGS, Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and Spain, whereas the worst case is the Greece case. And in the common with the common currency, these countries have lost their capacity to devalue, which has reinforced the German advantage, particularly as Germany post unification has really pushed down German unit labor costs and wage costs from unification. So the surplus has been massive.
I was just looking at the productivity statistics. Yeah. I was amazed how far Germany is ahead of just about everyone else in Europe. And throwing all these countries together in direct competition to the same currency zone with Germany is just, you know, it's impossible.
It is impossible, I think.
But how's the thing going to stay together, I wonder?
I can't see it either. I think it's hard to see how the Greeks can stay in, given the amount of austerity that has to occur to attempt to correct their current account deficit with Germany is just enormous. And this will rip apart a whole set of distributional and social relations inside Greece, which is why the strikes have been growing in momentum, not receding at this point in time. So I think that is a huge tension. It could be the first case of one of the countries having to exit for a period, and that's why so many different components within Europe are debating the conditions on which the Greeks might return to their own currency, because it's very difficult to see how they'll get out of it. Under what conditions the Germans are all of a sudden going to start raising German wages? Not so clear either, to be the compensating side to the Greek austerity. So it's reproducing the same contradiction that has been in place in the European Union for quite a while.
Well, it's almost like a 19th century deflationary approach to economic crisis, though. It's
well,
there's no German Keynes.
Sorry. No, I was going to say, it's very 20th century. You know, part of the point of the EU and the euro was to impose discipline across the board. And what discipline would mean here is massive, as Greg said, massive austerity. And people are fighting back. If they accepted it, you'd have a solution.
That's the voice of Sam Gidman. Before him, Greg Albo and also Leo Panitch here in the studio. They are the authors of In and Out of Crisis, The Global Financial Meltdown and Left Alternatives, a new little book, essential little book out from PM Press. Sam, since you spent many years advising the Canadian Auto Workers Union, you know a lot about the auto industry, and I think the auto what is the relation of the auto industry to this, what looks like a financial crisis? You know, you always point to auto, the restructuring of auto as an example of just how the industrial sector is deeply involved in neoliberalism. It's not a switch out of industry into finance, the way a lot of people say. It's not like there's a common analysis that the real sector produced too few profits, so the that capital was then pumped into the financial sector in the search of higher profits. You don't buy that argument at all, right? What happened in auto that refutes that argument?
There's two ways in which auto is important, I think, to what we're saying. One is the relationship to finance, and the other is the relationship to American decline. And if you start with the question of finance and you look at the issues in auto, what you find is no problem in terms of finance draining auto profits and taking it away from investment. Investment has actually been very high in auto, and finance has actually been very supportive of the auto industry in the sense of providing money to GM's financial arm, and through that to people to buy cars on credit, also to restructuring and the outsourcing of GM to parts suppliers who could then fund their own operations. It's been very important for, as Leo was saying earlier, for GM becoming and expanding globally, because it could hedge its risks in terms of exchange rates and interest rates and other uncertainties. So there's very little evidence of finance being a drawback. If anything, it's really provided cheap credit and crucial services. In terms of the question of decline, there's a few things that are important. One, the first is the question of whether auto is still the paradigm for whether we should judge whether U.S. is number one or not. I think when I started working for the auto workers, you could say that. Today, if you were testing whether the U.S. is dynamic, you wouldn't be looking at auto. You'd probably be looking at what's happening in nanotechnology and computers and biotechnology, et cetera.
Derivatives.
I think also looking at, not just finance, but all the business services that are absolutely crucial in terms of consulting, accountancy, legal, and, you know, the U.S. role in the global economy in terms of concentrating on that. The other thing that I think is important on the question of decline is, it's one thing to look at GM and say that GM is in trouble, but that doesn't mean that the industry is in decline. There's been an enormous amount of investment in the industry because what's happened is that Toyota hasn't just exported to the United States. It wouldn't have been able to just export that. It's actually invested in the U.S. and contributed to the strength of the U.S. and U.S. suppliers. And even GM has been able to take advantage of this crisis, and you can see what's happening relative to Toyota right now, to get rid of its debt, cut its collective agreement, cut benefit costs, get rid of its least efficient plants so it can come out stronger. So both Ford and GM are coming out relatively strong. But the auto industry
as a whole
is still strong.
You don't think the whole Toyota thing is a setup by the U.S. government, the sugar daddy of GM now, to improve the U.S. auto industry's competitive position?
Sure, they're all taking advantage of that, obviously. And I include everybody. I mean, auto workers are taking advantage of that, taking pride from the fact that they can bash Toyota. Yeah, that's been common.
Oh, well, let's talk. I always leave this part of the discussion too far to the end, so let's try to move it up a little bit. What should we do about this situation? Obviously, there's not much in the way of political ferment coming from below that I can see in North America, but we can sort of pre-associate on a better way of getting out of this crisis than what Henry Paulson, George Bush, Tim Geithner, and Barack Obama have come up with. So let's start with it's almost getting too late to talk about what to do at the banks because, you know, the money has been spent and they're supposedly on their way back to health. But, you know, what would a better way to rehabilitate the financial sector have been than what we saw?
Well, you know, at the time, back at the time of TARP and into the first few months of the Obama presidency, there were a lot of people talking about nationalizing the banks. Even the Brookings Institute put out a paper on that. In fact, a few of them were nationalized, but in the typically capitalist way of nationalizing and then giving them back to the capitalists after socializing the debt and the losses. In our view, it will be essential for people to come to the realization that if they're going to ever get out from under of this kind of insecurity and inequality that has driven them into this crisis, the financial system is going to have to be taken into the public domain and be made part of a process of democratic economic planning. That is absolutely essential. It goes back to where we started this discussion. Finance and speculation are central to capitalism. The left, for far too long, has naively looked back at the neoliberal period as a period supposedly where finance was regulated so that capitalism was stable, rather than seeing that period as a period in which finance capital was nurtured back to health. It always must be so in a capitalist system. People look naively to Europe, and not least to Germany, forgetting that it was the so-called social democratic Germany in the 1970s that put most pressure on the United States to do what Volcker finally did, that is to break and defeat U.S. trade unionism in order to stabilize the value of the dollar. The Germans have always been most monetarist, most committed to the soundness of currency above everything else. And for the left to look to Europe as an alternative within capitalism is very, very problematic. We need to revive the understanding that there's no getting out of this dilemma unless we find, rethink the way to a democratic socialism. The forces aren't there for it. We don't have the horses. But the contribution of this book is to try to put that on the agenda.
You're all pointing at each other. Who's next?
Well, let me just continue by using auto as an example. If you looked at the auto industry and you said, you know, there's this massive unemployment, there's never been this level of unemployment in the industry, what do you do about it? What you don't want to do about it is think about stimulating the auto industry. We don't need more cars, for one thing. And second of all, you couldn't solve it that way. There's massive excess capacity in the industry. And what you'd have to think about in the auto industry is to get your head beyond the auto industry. You'd have to think about the fact of what else is there useful that we could do, and instead of trying to save the companies, how could we use the productive capacity that's there in terms of the machinery and the equipment and the skills of the workers to do something else? And the obvious thing that we should be thinking about is that if we're serious about the environment, then everything about what we do in the rest of the century is going to have to be changed, from infrastructure to every single factory and the machinery that's used to offices to homes. And so there should be a massive attempt at conversion. Now, that could only be done, getting back to what Leo said, through some kind of democratic planning. This can't happen just by some subsidies to business or hoping that business will do it. So, again, it puts on the question, on the agenda, issues of democracy, of some kind of social planning, of not just being dependent on corporations and trying to repeatedly save them.
The problem with injecting democracy into this, though, is that there's no great popular longing for this agenda.
No.
No, absolutely.
So it's supply and demand. To some extent, supply creates a demand. In other words, we do need to be making this case. We need a leadership that makes this case. Tragically, far from doing that, Obama, as Paulson says in his recent book, took it upon himself to do the right thing. And the right thing was defined as not making the capitalist crisis any worse.
Well, there's some people who would say that this crisis is, not that many, but some people would say that this crisis is a lesson in the need to deglobalize, to go back to the small and the local and the homey. Greg, you've written on that. What do you think of that idea?
Well, I think it's partly right, but poses the question wrongly. It really is a linking to a question of widening democracy and then attempting to reduce the scale of the market as a key orientation. I think just putting it as deglobalization misses a lot of the fact that a lot of things have to be produced on a very large scale, involve a range of trade, involve a range of planning. So simply focusing on the local exclusively, I think, is an unsolution. The local has to be thought of as a place where we're building capacities, but it's then absolutely a question of how we will link on a national scale for the types of questions that are around bank nationalization that Leo was raising. This is at a national level, the kinds of capital controls that have to be imposed so you can deal with the asymmetries in the world market that we were dealing with before that would allow a country like China still to develop without depending it on the particular way of such an export surplus dependent structure, so it could develop in a more balanced way. So those things cannot be solved at just the local level. So we need the things that connect beyond it. I think the local level, in a range of things, with the kinds of lack of political capacities we don't have right now, are essential. But even when we think of something that you would do build at a local level in some ways, at particular workplaces in and around work time struggles, to make that adequate has to be generalized across the class and has to be moved beyond particular workplaces to a national struggle over work time reduction as a fundamental way of dealing with capacity building. Similarly with green conversion, you're going to convert particular plants. In Ontario, where we're from, there's a huge movement towards converting energy, but this cannot handle just at a local level. It's having to be coordinated at the level of both the provincial and the national states to put the resources that are necessary into it. Now, it's allowing us then in different ways to do more things at a local level, but it's dependent upon these extra local capacities to do so, and I think that's where we're needing a political project, because that's specifically what political projects allow us to do. They move us from particular places to wider communities, and many of the challenges we face are in these wider communities, and that's what a political practice is about.
All right, we have to bring it to an end there. That was the voice of Greg Alba, who is the co-author of In and Out of Crisis, The Global Financial Meltdown and Left Alternatives, along with Sam Gindin and Leo Panitch, who we've also been hearing from, this just out from PM Press. Okay, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week. Let's go out with this. In honor of our Canadian guest, this is a Canadian band, The Weaker Thens. Our retired explorer dines with Michel Foucault in Paris, 1961. All right, till next week. Bye.
Just one more drink and then I should be on my way home. I'm not entirely sure what you're talking about. Black Shackleton, come on, darling. Who says what do we come see? Come down. Yes, a penguin taught me French back in Antarctica. Oh, I could show you the way shadows colonize. Breaking up on the bay, off the Lassiter coast, light failing over the pole, as every longitude leads up to your frostbitten feet.